Hello and welcome back to the Mobile Chicanes for another week. It's our review of the Monaco Grand Prix and the Indianapolis 500, plus all the other action that happened over the weekend. It was probably one of the biggest weekends in motorsports all year. You don't need to discuss it all. Well, it's Joshua Carroll-Walden. We'll head straight into the latest from the world of Formula One and the Monaco Grand Prix, which was won in somewhat controversial circumstances, depending on who you ask, by Sebastian Vettel, who came from the front row of the grid, second place in qualifying, to upset his teammate Kimi Raikkonen, who was on pole position and was leading for the first half or so of the race. He passed him in the pit stop phase and went on to win. It's a win that's divided a lot of fans, and there's been a lot of talk about team orders, particularly because Ferrari has precedent with this in the past. Josh, do you really think that Ferrari stooped that low, or do you think it was just Vettel was just faster on the day?
Realistically, I can't see how this is team orders. Generally, the passage of play in F1 is, in terms of pit stops, that lead car has priority. And I'm pretty sure that Raikkonen did actually ask to pit on that particular lap. Whereas Vettel, you know, he was happy. You know, he's actually very quiet for most of the race on team radio. You know, he was just doing his own thing. And I think, you know, what it came down to was how Sebastian Vettel used his tyres. Like, he was very, very strategic in that race, because as soon as Raikkonen was out of his way, he just banged in purple lap times and purple sectors along with Ricciardo. So, and also as well, like, I mean, you know, just something to debunk the team orders theory is Red Bull did exactly the same thing as Ferrari, pitting Max Verstappen in the lead car first, and then Ricciardo second later on. Once again, Daniel Ricciardo belted out purple lap times, and Verstappen's race was pretty much over as he was behind Valtteri Bottas, who was the big mystery of the race. Qualifying, you know, Valtteri Bottas did what could be only known as a Valtteri Bottas performance for 2017, and then in the race, just something not right with his Mercedes. And, you know, whatever was wrong with Bottas's Mercedes, it certainly wasn't impacting Hamilton's race as much, as Hamilton looked much more comfortable and much more pacey, even though he was in the middle of the field, than Bottas was with the lead group.
Yeah, it's interesting. And with that team orders, you look at the lap times, and generally they were about even Stevens. If anything, Sebastian Vettel was, if anything, just being effectively holding back. He was doing very well to preserve a 1.5-second gap. And it was just luck the way the strategy played out. And I think Vettel in particular really put on the pace. As you can see, after Raikkonen's pit stop, if you look on the lap times, you see a big spike in Raikkonen pits, and you can see Vettel's lap times are probably the fastest they've been all weekend, including a 1 minute 15, which is, I think, the fastest lap that he did all race, at which point he just came out ahead, and that was not surprising. And to be honest, you saw that Raikkonen wasn't necessarily disappointed about that as much. I mean, we've heard this at this point on the radio in the past, so a similar thing, he could have similarly had another outburst this weekend, but he didn't. So I guess he sort of was admitted that he probably wasn't the fastest driver on the day. And Sebastian Vettel was the second fastest driver of the day. Sergio Perez the fastest, although he had a very interesting race, and we'll talk about that as well. Also, Josh mentioned just what on earth was going on with Mercedes. It was a very, very odd weekend for all of them because, well, first of all, Lewis Hamilton didn't make it into Q3 on pace, effectively, for the first time since, I think, 2013 or something like that. Certainly the first time in a long time. He was a bit unlucky in that he was caught out on his final lap with Stoffel van Dorn crashing out at the second chicane. But yeah, it wasn't the greatest performance from him, although he did well to claw his way back into the top 10. The complete no-show from Valtteri Bottas, though, was surprising. I think it showed the fact that he wasn't even able to make the overcut one that can't work on the Red Bulls, which is quite extraordinary. Just the pace that the Red Bulls have had, and I guess the pace that Mercedes hasn't had.
And it does show that if they stuff up, there is certainly going to be another team, whether it be Ferrari or Red Bull, that will make them pay.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they said throughout the weekend that, you know, they just had so much issues, you know, turning on the tyres and heating them up. Yeah, that's very reminiscent of what Manor had last year. You know, Pascal Wehrlein said last year that Manor were consistently struggling, you know, with turning on their tyres and making them hot and, you know, getting them up to a good temperature. And, yeah, just once again, you know, just... Mercedes just, you know, it took three or four laps for them to get up to speed. Like, you know, the Ferraris and the Red Bulls, they didn't have the problem. And this is the first time this has come up this year. Granted, it is Monaco. But, you know, you still have to consider, you know, when F1 heads to the colder tracks, you know, Canada will be a cold track in a couple of weeks' time. You know, you just wonder whether they're automatically out of contention when you actually factor into mind that the Ferrari can turn on the tyres so much better than the Mercedes. So, yeah, if this is a problem that's going to keep popping up, you know, at the cooler races, you know, you really have to, you can almost start panicking at Mercedes, because, you know, any slight advantage that you continue to give Sebastian Vettel and Ferrari, you know, they're going to be fully capitalized, and that's what they did last weekend.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the fact that Ferrari now looks like it's a more than a one-dimensional car. It's good on all sorts of different circuits, including the pace circuits, as well as the downforce circuits like Monaco. So yeah, we really don't know exactly where that's going to lead us later this year, although it does show that we do certainly have a far closer battle than I think anybody originally expected. And of course, that does leave an interesting tail in the standings. At the moment, Sebastian Vettel with a 25-point lead. That's one full Grand Prix win already over Lewis Hamilton. That's a big lead at this part of the year. And it will, of course, probably be shortened up. And certainly how close it's been so far is a good thing. But it doesn't exactly look good for Lewis Hamilton, that he's struggled, really, to find his way back in there. And of course, the constructor standings, that's now Ferrari are well ahead of Mercedes by 17 or so points. So it's going to be a real difficult one for them to call that back. It's going to be very close, I think, over the next few weeks. Now, before we finish off talking about Monaco, we need to talk about the last 30 laps, which are absolutely shocking in terms of driving standards. I mean, we've talked about how the 2017 regulations have really sorted out the wheat from the chaff in terms of drivers, and things didn't exactly improve. I mean, once we actually have a look at exactly what happened, we only had, 15 or so finishes. Lance Stroll, surprisingly, was one of them. But first off, we had this bizarre incident with Jenson Button, who was, of course, the super sub this weekend. And aside from a good qualifying performance, really wasn't that spectacular. And in terms of his incident with Pascal Wehrlein, where at Portier, he comes and swipes him and ends up tipping Wehrlein rather dangerously. He flips him, and then because of how narrow the barriers are, he just goes... And gets embedded on his side next to the barrier at the end of Portier. It's a really scary incident, particularly for Wehrlein, who's had injury concerns earlier this year. But it just looks really lazy for Jenson Button, who now has, somewhat ironically, a points penalty and a grid penalty and two super license points on probation for his next race, which probably won't be for quite some time. So, but it's not really exactly how you want to remember Jenson Button's last race, would you, Josh? I mean, he sort of has spoiled a little bit of his legacy, and I think he might regret coming back to Monaco for a race that, to be honest, he wasn't really that enthused about.
Yeah, well, you know, it certainly, you know, wasn't the weekend that went to plan. For McLaren in general, really, like, you know, the McLarens were very, very strong in qualifying, both Van Dorn and Button getting into Q3. So massive praise to both of them for their qualifying efforts. Unfortunately, you know, the bad luck returned with Van Dorn crashing it into the barriers at the exit of the swim pool chicane. You know, which is unfortunate. I think Van Dorn was just at the stage where he did the best lap he could ever do around Monaco without, you know, flirting with the barriers. You know, just because how terrible that McLaren is. I don't really know how close he got, how how good Q2 lap was, because I haven't seen an onboard yet. And you know, he was just trying to find a lap time that he probably was trying to find a lap time that just wasn't possible. So that very well could be a result. And Jensen, you know, just doing what he's done, you know, in the past, you know, just getting that absolute dog of a car up into Q3. Had a bit of a tyre issues and pace issues in Q3, finishing ninth, but not too far behind the rest of the guys in Q3, which is a positive to look at. And then everything just went terribly wrong. You know, Van Dorn, three-place grid penalty for his collision with Massa in Barcelona, so that relegated him to 12th alongside Hamilton, and then buttoned the back of the field for changes to the power unit. And that's basically where he stayed. Like, I do admire both McLaren and Sauber's, you know, outward thinking of, you know, getting in the first, you know, basically, you know, the two Saubers, we'll talk about them first. The two Saubers, you know, define the rest of the field and trying to basically do what they did with Wehrlein in Barcelona and, you know, play a different strategy game. And they started on the super soft tyres and pitted Wehrlein in basically immediately onto ultra soft tyres, which, you know, very well could have been a good strategy. But, you know, Monaco being Monaco, you know, really just wasn't worth it in the end. And same with Button, you know, from ultra soft to super soft. So, but both bold strategies from both McLaren and Sauber. And, unfortunately, you know, just, those two coming together at Portier. And Button, you know, was like, you know, in the post-race interview, Button basically said, you know, it was like, yes, let's go for it. It's like, actually, no, you know, back out of it. And you just can't back out of a move around Portier. Like, once you make the move, you make the move. And, he just wasn't close enough to the back of Wehrlein at the exit of the hairpin at the hotel. As, you know, he could have, you know, just followed straight in, you know, really, you know, tried to go full balls and, you know, get the power down very early, follow him through the tunnel and then just move to the inside or outside, depending on how Wehrlein plays it, into the Novel chicane. So, yeah, just disappointing. Like, you know, I do like Jensen and I didn't want him to go out this way and I don't want Wehrlein to get, flashbacks to Race of Champions. So it was a really unfortunate crash, but yeah, Jensen was just a bit too eager, which is certainly understandable because this, let's not forget, this was his first race with the atrocious dirty air. And, you know, he would have definitely been getting frustrated with how much dirty air was affecting the front of his car.
Indeed. I mean, he mentioned earlier in the race in an interview with Fernando Alonso, who's in Indianapolis, and we will talk about that a bit later, when they got him to do a live satellite link-up before the race, and he said he might pee on Alonso's seat, and there's a good chance he probably did that during that incident, unfortunately. And then after that, in the safety car, directly after the safety car, there was these two really weird but really similar incidents involving Marcus Ericsson and Stoffel Vandoorne. Separate incidents, but they did the exact same thing, in that they went off at the first corner, Santa Devot, straight into the wall, which was really bizarre. I guess they sort of strayed onto the marbles a bit, and there was talk there might be some oil there, because Nico Hülkenberg had an engine failure in his Renault earlier on in the race. But yeah, really odd and really disappointing. I guess it's not been a great weekend for Vandoorne in general, but this is a track that always catches the rookies out, you'd have to say. Lance Stroll was, of course, caught out in qualifying practice early, although he managed to finish the race. But yeah, not the greatest way to finish off the weekend for McLaren Honda. We'll talk about the other exports of McLaren Honda on the other side of the world as well. So, looking through the race results, it was Sebastian Vettel who came out on top despite some, because of some very good strategy calls from Ferrari. Kimi Raikkonen in second. A good weekend for Daniel Ricciardo in third, just keeping on his form at Monaco. Valtteri Bottas in fourth. Max Verstappen in fifth. I thought Verstappen was probably the unappreciated performer in that he didn't actually hit a wall, which is the first time Max Verstappen has actually finished the race at Monaco. So, a very strong result from him, even though he was jumped in the pit stop stage, and he could have possibly been on for a podium
And of course, he did qualify faster than Ricciardo, which is part of Ricciardo and Verstappen. Those qualifying battles will get more and more interesting. Carlos Sainz at 6th, another solid result in the Toro Rosso. He's really working well with that. Carlos Lewis Hamilton 7th, just sailing under the radar. Two Hasses in the points, 8th and 10th for Romain Grosjean and Kevin Magnussen. With Felipe Massa sandwiched in the middle, another solid performance from him. Then it's Jolyon Palmer, Jolyon 50% Palmer. Solid results given the doubt that surrounds his seat, mainly because he's Formula One merchandise has gone on discount on the Formula One store. Then it's Esteban Ocon, Sergio Perez, a really disappointing weekend for the Force Indians, really, this track that they should be strong at. Then Daniel Kvyat just sailing under the radar again, and Lance Stroll in 50th place. So all in all, another solid weekend for Ferrari, very strong weekend. We look forward to what happens when we head to Canada, the first American race of the year. Let's now head across to Indianapolis, the Indianapolis 500 over the weekend. And the big surprise winner, we've had another surprise winner, and it was the first Japanese winner in Indy 500 history, Takuma Sato. The very wild Japanese driver, the 40-year-old ex-Formula One veteran, came through, won a thrilling shootout with Helio Castroneves, who was gunning for his fourth Indy 500 title. And let's face it, it is a well-deserved win for Sato, something that I don't think many people would have thought he would have been able to do, because he is someone who is a bit of a weak spot for oval, so I was incredibly impressed with his performance and the way he was able to hold on in those final 10 few laps.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it was a very un-Takuma Sato performance. Like, normally he does the exact opposite, but yeah, just amazing. And let's not forget, this is Takuma Sato's second ever win in his IndyCar Series career, the first being at Long Beach a few years ago. So this is only his second win, and just caught everyone out by surprise, we said earlier this year that Takuma Sato is just continuously struggling with ovals, and to come out on top in a duel with Helio Castroneves, who's always up there at the end of the day, in who also by the way came through from the back rows and then came through and almost won the race. It was a fantastic performance from Helio. So he was certainly on top of his game. So Takuma decided to hold on, just get through all the crashes that, occurred in the final 20 laps. It was a fantastic, performance and, something no one really expected. Like, yes, we expected a Honda to win, but definitely not this Honda. Like, I thought Takuma Sato was going to be an interesting prospect heading into the 500, but, I'd never really considered him for a top 5, top 10 finish, and yet, he goes ahead on Sunday and absolutely wins it, which is, it just showcases to the world the beauty of IndyCar, the unpredictability of IndyCar, the Indy 500 itself, it really sets up what is a very, very interesting and very, very juicy championship battle with a three-way tie for second place in the standings.
Yes, that will certainly be a very interesting battle indeed as we come through the next few weeks. So that was Takuma Sato, came out on top ahead of Helio Castroneves. Ed Jones, the only full-time rookie in the year, coming in third. That is a very solid performance from him. He's really been impressing a lot of people this year, I guess, with how strong he and Dale Coyne Racing have been. So to get third place is a strong result from him. In general, it was a very dominant weekend for Andretti, not surprising. I mean, at some point during the race, we at least had an Andretti driver in the top five, if not more, two or three. Very unlucky, though, the two guys who did run out, fall out due to engine issues, Ryan Hunter-Reay and Fernando Alonso. Now, before we go any further, we do need to discuss Fernando Alonso's Indy 500, which was exceptional for a first-timer, and I guess for somebody who we thought would struggle, he was running within the top three for the first two-thirds of the race. He was very strong. He was taking the lead. He was doing everything we expected an experienced IndyCar driver to do on an oval in terms of alternating the lead and working to build a gap and running a slipstream and saving fuel. And he did all of that pretty well, except for possibly some
some very concerning moments at the start of the race where he was in the wrong fuel map. But other than that, an exceptional performance from him. He knew exactly what to do with the car. He knew that the best thing to do at the start would be to drop back a little bit and then work his way forward. And he carried himself exceptionally well. He was in 7th place. He was, unfortunately, he wasn't in the top 5. Pit stops shuffled him back, and then his engine blew with about 20 laps to go, a disappointing way to end the race for Fernando Alonso. But in general, it was a very, very strong performance, and he carried himself, and in Formula 1, exceptionally well, you would have to say, Josh.
Yeah, and the most important thing is he also really enjoyed himself. Like, you know, he actually said in the post-race interviews that, you know, this is one of the best motoring, motoring experiences of his career, of his life. So, yeah, it shows really high regard about how much IndyCar is enjoyable for a driver on the inside coming in. So, yeah, he's vowed to return. It really will depend on deals and, like, I mean, I'm sure Zach Brown and Liberty Media will still be okay with it. Continue to build, on what has been a fantastic year, for Formula One in the United States. The standing ovation he got, you know, when he was, walking down the pit lane, and down Gasoline Alley, after his, engine light was exceptional. Like, the fans at Indianapolis last weekend were absolutely fantastic, both in numbers. Like, ESPN F1, you know, actually, excuse me, basically filmed the massive lineup of cars hanging into the car park, as they made their way to the circuit, in the morning. And, everyone there, you know, all the F1 journalists, you know, Autosport, ESPN, F1, Speed, you know, all of them, you know, really enjoyed themselves and made a personal recommendation for F1 fans, you know, people around the world, to come to next year's Indy 500. So, yeah, just an amazing weekend for cross promotion. Like, I really want to see more of this, not with just F1 and IndyCar, but, you know, with NASCAR, World Endurance Championship, MotoGP, Supercars, Formula E, DTM, BTTC, World Touring Car Championship, World Rallycross Championship, World Rally Championship, you know, the lot. I want it all. So, yeah, I really hope that everyone gets on board, and, you know, more cross promotion is always good promotion. So, yeah, just a fantastic weekend, and, the Indy 500, you know, has just confirmed, you know, its prestige on the world stage.
And it helped that it was an absolutely thrilling race. I mean, every restart, there were cars going 3-4 wide on the back straight. It was phenomenal. And I guess it was the first Indy 500, which I think I've watched in full without knowing the result. But it was also, a very tense race indeed. You didn't know. There were so many gutsy moves going on. There was so much happening. There were people running in and out. Rossi was very strong. Max Chilton could have possibly run away with it, which would have been a real surprise. Of course, the big moment that made headlines around the world was the really, really frightening crash of Scott Dixon and Jay Howard. Howard ending up on the marbles, goes into the wall, careers back out, tags. Well, Dixon tries to dodge, but moves a little bit too late, and tags the back of him, flies over the top of Helio Castroneves, into the catch fencing, injuring a marshal. But very luckily, Scott Dixon was able to escape without serious injury. I think the only thing he picked up was possibly some ankle sprain.
He's got an ankle. I think the official word right now is a sprain, but, you know, he's just got some damage to his ankle right now.
Yeah, and hopefully he can mend that. But that was an incredible testament to the safety of IndyCar. That a big flying shot. Not only was that everything was safe, he was safe within the safety cell, the car, when it broke apart, and, like, when you looked at the images, the entire back of the car, the engine had completely been blown off. There was only one wheel attached to the tethers to the actual monocoque safety cell section. But it was an exceptional testament, I guess, to the strength of the Indy cars and just how safe they are. And, of course, there were some other incidents as well that we do need to talk about. And we will talk about, I guess, James Davison, who really impressed. He's 30 years old, so he's not exactly a youngster, but he hasn't had a lot of IndyCar experience. And thrown in at the deep end after Sebastian Bourdais terrifying shows in practice, in the first day of qualifying. He did exceptionally well to be running up in the top five, and you have to say he's really there without a good impression, and I hope he... And it looks like he might get some more seat time at Dale Coyne, which is only a good thing. And it's only a good thing to have another Australian, I guess, in the IndyCar series.
Yeah, for sure. And, him and our fellow countrymen, I should say, Matt Brabham, were both, I think it was Matt Brabham who Sebastian Bourdais, basically recommended to Dale Coyne, but they went with James Davison instead. And you have to say, that both James Davison and Matt Brabham are both very deserving of more seat time in the IndyCar series. It's really unfortunate that both James Davison and Will Power both were involved in that big, not as big as Scott Dixon, but, that big crash with about 17 laps to go, as they were both, right up there and, generally in contention. So, it's a real shame for both of them. And, it was really disappointing. And, it took out a lot of key runners. But, that's just something that, would always happen at Indianapolis and Talladega and Daytona and, all the other ovals. But, just the chance for the big one. And, you do have to be lucky to win on the super speedways, and unfortunately the luck wasn't there for James Davison, Oriol Servia, and Will Power with 17 laps to go. So it's unfortunate, but it is oval racing, so you've just got to take it on the chin. I don't think it's been announced yet who Sebastian Bourdais' replacement going to be for the Jill in Detroit this next week, definitely James Davison would be a very, very strong candidate after his fantastic performance at Indianapolis.
Yeah, you'd have to say he's really up there and really proven himself, I guess, as the surprise performer. To be honest, yeah, probably the surprise performer and the underrated performer of the field. So let's look through the whole results, numbers 1 to 33. Takuma Sato takes the win, a very solid drive from him, particularly not to pin it at any point. Helio Castroneves in second, Ed Jones for Dale Coyne Racing in third. Following them is the two Chip Ganassi Racing cars with Max Chilton. Very giving surprise. Tony Kanaan, not surprising. He's been very strong. Juan Pablo Montoya, a good one-off result from him to finish up in sixth place. Alexander Rossi, sort of unlucky to win it. He had an unlucky delayed pit stop, and that sort of shunted him out of contention. But, of course, with what the cars that happened later in the top ten, he was able to move up to seventh. Then Marco Andretti sort of flew under the radar for Andretti there in eighth. Gabby Chavez moving up to ninth. Pretty good performance in ordinary machinery for him. Carlos Munoz in 10th. AJ Foyt, solid performance for him. Not really a superb weekend for Foyt. Ed Carpenter, he'll be disappointed to have dropped out of the top 10 after leading early, but he was caught up in the midfield and got some damage later on in the race, finished 11th. Graham Ray Holland, 12th. Just generally a very average weekend for Graham Ray Holland. He sort of struggled with the machinery all so far this year. Michaela Lotion in 13th for Smith Peterson Motorsports. Simon Pagano in 14th for Penske. Was sort of running up in the top 10 for some times, but just stuck in the midfield. Sebastian Zavedra 15th for Yukos Racing. J.R. Hildebrand for Ed Carpenter Racing in 16th. Another disappointing, a disappointing result for him considering how strong he was earlier in the race. Pippa Mann, 17th. Not too bad for Pippa Mann and Dale Coyne as well, flying the British flag, as well as the flag for women in motorsport. Spencer Pickett in 18th in New Coast Racing. Joseph Newgarden, another disappointing one for him, I guess, in 19th, and really wasn't able to make the inroads with Penske. Was caught up in that crash with Servia, Davison, Power and Hinchcliffe. I was lucky to escape without any major damage. He was the last, I guess, of the finishes, 15 laps down, which just sort of sums up the bad day he was having. James Davison, when we look to the casualty ward, I guess, James Davison, 20th, crashed out 17 laps to go, along with Oriol Servia, James Hinchcliffe, Will Power, Fernando Alonso, with 21 laps to go, engine gone, Charlie Kimmel, the same thing happened to him, Zach Veach, a similar thing happened to the Ford car as well, Ryan Hunter-Reay was also running up the top at the lead before engine problems struck him as well. Similar thing with Sage Karen Buddy Lazier crashing out
the oldest guy in the field, 48, the defending 1996 Indy 500 winner, depending on whether you call the Indy 500 and 1996 an actual race, given the Indy Racing League at the time. But he was there in 29th. And Connor Daly, a very disappointing weekend for him, but forced out onto the marbles when racing with Charlie Kimball and withdrew to the wall. And of course, Jack Harvey and Scott Dixon, or Jack Harvey, who retired a couple of laps around the same time, I think, as a result of that. I think, and then Scott Dixon and Jay Helmer were the first two major casualties. And that leaves us with a very interesting standing. Takuma Sato moves up to join second. That just shows just how well things are. Here is the list at the moment. Helio Castroneves takes the lead of the championship for his strong performance. I don't think he's actually taken a win, but he's been very strong, and he's now taken the lead. Simon Pagenaud in second. So the Penske is still out in fourth. Takuma Sato in third, the highest place of the Honda runners, the Andretti runners. Then Scott Dixon, Alexander Rossi in fifth, Tony Kanaan in sixth, all power. Sort of stuck in seventh, Joseph Newgarden, Ed Jones, and James Hinchcliffe, who round out the top 10. Fernando Alonso now there in 25th. So he's got, I think, 47 points, more points than he will have, certainly this year.
Yeah, yeah. In Formula One. Wouldn't that be more points than he's had since McLaren Honda joined?
Yeah, probably, actually. So,
I don't know. He'll still probably get more money from Formula One than IndyCar, but. We'll see. Hopefully he'll turn up next year. But yes, in general, a very good, a very very exciting, thrilling Indy 500. Takuma Sato the winner in what will be a big... I guess it's a big deal for Honda. It's a Japanese driver who they've been paying through the nose for, well, almost 20 years. Almost 20 years, but almost 15 years now since his involvement in Formula 1. Honda have consistently been supporting Takuma Sato, and now here is the vindication, his win, and hopefully he does great things for Japanese motorsport, and we do, because I would like to see more drivers from the land of the rising sun certainly take on the world's best, and it's nice to see that Sato can fight it out there with the best.
Yeah, and Japanese motorsport right now has got all the ingredients in place. Like Super Formula in Japan is held in a very, very high regard. You know, it's very, very high on the open wheel pyramid. You know, it's where Pierre Gasly is this year. You know, it's where Stoffel Van Dorn was last year. So, you know, it must be a really good category when you consider that Stoffel Van Dorn didn't really win that many races last year in Super Formula. So, yeah, the ingredients are there, and certainly not all of them can go up into F1, as, you know, I think it's only Norbu Masashita who's in Formula 2 right now. So IndyCar, would look pretty attractive to all those that are just not going to have the funding or the ability to get up into F2 and then into F1. So, yeah, it could be, you know, a very attractive alternative, and surely when Takuma Sato does eventually retire from IndyCar full time, he will go back to Japan and mentor the next great Japanese open wheelers. Whether they're going to go into F1 or into IndyCar, so yeah, that they could go either way. So yeah, they've got all the ingredients, you know, Formula 4. And Super Formula, you know, two very good categories at their disposal. And, there's no reason why someone can't go Super Formula into IndyCar, or Super Formula into Formula 2 into Formula 1.
Yeah, certainly should be plenty of opportunities for Japanese drivers into the future. So there was also plenty of other action around the weekend. The Coca-Cola 600 was on effectively as the... whatever the opposite of a curtain raiser is, I guess the closing act, the dessert to the Monaco entree in the Indy 500 main course. And it was Austin Dillon who took his first cup win in the longest race in NASCAR, conquering 600 miles at Charlotte's Motor Speedway and a thunderstorm in the middle of Stage 2 to take the win. He took the lead with one lap remaining, and Jimmy Johnson ran out of fuel. And Dillon effectively did the same thing as Alexander Rossi last year, ran on a fuel run and managed to make it in. So a very strong result there for Austin Dillon.
Yeah, a fantastic result for him. And it's also the first time since... But I think basically since the 2000 Talladega 500, when Dale Earnhardt Sr. produced that memorable comeback from about, you know, I think it was 20th at that day, all the way back to take the win, his final win, unfortunately, at the Talladega 500 in the fall. So, yeah, great to see the number three back in victory lane. And, I've lost my words here. And
let's just have a look at the standings while Josh regathers himself. For the first time in the season, I think Kyle Larson has lost the lead of the championship. He's now dropped behind Martin Truex Jr., who had his strong results at Charlotte to finish in first place. And then Brad Keselowski in third, Kevin Harvick in fourth, Kyle Busch in fifth. We also have some other news I want to talk about in terms of the 2018 Cup schedule that was released late last week, and the fact that we now have Charlotte as a road course for next year, which means that there's now a road course in the playoffs, which I think will be very interesting, and because it's a place that's sort of unfamiliar to a lot of the guys, I think it's really going to throw up some big surprises.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I've personally driven Charlotte road course in a simulator, and you know, it can be a pretty challenging circuit. Like you know, it's pretty tight, and you know, certainly wasn't designed with NASCAR in mind. There's going to be a few good passing opportunities. Obviously, in turn one, turn five is going to be good. Possibly turn nine, and then you know, there's around the oval itself, as it'll be. You know, it's basically an unheard of challenge for NASCAR, you know, having basically a roval, you know, part road course, part oval. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they, you know, deal with the setup, of the cars. And, cause, you know, they will have a, you know, blank piece of paper at the start of the weekend to work with. So setup's going to be absolutely crucial, at Charlotte in 2018, and I personally think it's good. You know, I think, you know, having three races at Charlotte on the oval course, you know, is a bit too much. You know, with the All-Star Race, the 600, and then the race in the fall. I think, you know, this will, you know, spice it up and, you know, make the All-Star Race in the 600 a bit more special. So yeah, it's good to see. Like, it wouldn't be the road course I'd choose, but you know, it's a road course at least, so it's going to be an absolute wild card race. And you know, when you factor in Talladega as well, which is always going to be in the chase, you know, it's fantastic. You know, just to have so many wild card races and so much unpredictability towards the end of a NASCAR season. So yeah, good stuff for NASCAR listening to the fans and delivering a road course in the chase. But not the road course that, you know, many people had in mind.
It will certainly be very interesting, particularly how we see the setup play out, because there's an almost new challenge with the NASCAR teams, and that will be a very interesting round indeed. Speaking of scheduling, let's move to supercars. As in the news that the Australian Grand Prix will host the Supercars Championship round next year in 2018. It's been long awaited. There's been lots of frantic negotiations between Supercars, Australian Grand Prix Corp, and Liberty Media, or Formula One Group, as they are technically known nowadays. They've always wanted to have a race here for a while, but have been held back, firstly, by television rights, particularly because it was, I think, from around 2006 to a couple of years ago, they had completely different broadcasters, so it was a bit messy. That's sort of sorted out now, I think, because Fox Sports and Channel 10 share the F1 rights, and I think Fox Sports is the main rights holder for supercars, whereas Channel 10 is the main rights holder for Formula 1. It was slightly complicated, which is the reason why Channel 10 produced the coverage of the Australian Grand Prix and the supercars around there in particular. But now Liberty, the negotiations with Liberty Media appear to have paid off, and we do have four races, as far as we know, set in stone for roughly 30-minute sprints to be made part of the format for next year. Whilst it's good that we are going to get a championship round and it gives people a reason to compete, and I guess it means that it's worth it for the teams, I'm personally still thinking that we still need some tweaks to the format, because I think my issue with sprint races is just that if you don't have a pit stop in them, they just turn into these really dull affairs, and Albert Park in particular, which is very difficult to overtake on, you do sort of need something to keep the field together, other than a safety car and the like. So
Personally, I'd like to see spice up the formula and possibly introduce some longer races, go for quality over quantity, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. And let's not forget, this is, F1 show. This is the Australian Grand Prix. So, supercars can't go pick and choose, what they like about this event. I personally, would prefer, if it was two 60-minute tours or two 75-minute races rather than four 30-minute races. So, I do think the format needs to be changed. If we do want to go to Albert Park, then, it should be a championship event. I don't really see the point of non-championship rounds anymore unless they're, six-car demos, we saw at the KL City Grand Prix a few years ago. It'll be good. It'll really spice up the action as, there's not really a circuit like Albert Park on the supercars calendar. And, hopefully, the format changes. It's still very early days. And the other support categories for the 2018 Australian Grand Prix are, far from being set in stone. So, it's, still very, very early days. But, one thing I can almost guarantee is that there will be, another surge of interest, another boost in crowd attendance because of this decision, as, it's going to be more serious for the supercars, teams and drivers. So they'll get going harder, going faster, and going for those big moves. So, it looks promising, but then again, Albert Park has never been a fantastic circuit for racing. It's always been a fantastic event, but not fantastic for racing. So, that issue, is reliable to both F1 and supercars. So, it's a step in the right direction. If we are going to keep going to Albert Park, we need it to be a championship event. The words have, resonating around the Australian motorsport community today is finally, it's finally here. It's finally happening. And, it's very good that this is, that this pipe dream has now, after so many years, after so many negotiations, after so many meetings, has finally become reality.
And the other question I guess I have to ask is what happens with the rolling starts, which of course are unique to the Australian Grand Prix round. Will they still be there? Will we switch to a standing start as per the rest of the championship? But there's still plenty to be locked down and plenty to be confirmed. So this weekend, there is not much happening. Formula One is taking a break. We are, however, going straight into the next round of the IndyCar Series at Detroit. Always a very good, street circuit, Detroit, in that it's got ample passing opportunities. It's very interesting. And, of course, for Australia's Will Power, it's a very strong track for him as well. Of course, he won last year. It would have been a strong track for Sebastian Bourdais, who I think had a hat-trick of wins going across the 2 years or something like that. But, unfortunately, he won't be there and able to compete, but expect Alpine Racing, hopefully, to get the setup right and to be up there. Hopefully, Ed Jones can carry the team as well. And also, Moto Grand Prix Italy at Mugello is also on, another Moto Grand Prix round, and of course another round another home race exactly for Alexander Rossi. Not his main home race, which is San Marino, but it will certainly be a well attended race, Josh, won't it?
Yeah, it always will, and it is also Jorge Lorenzo's. It is Jorge Lorenzo's, basically favorite track. He's had such a fantastic run there in the past, and, he's had a long streak of wins there. So, another very interesting MotoGP weekend coming up. As always, as the rest of the season has gone, it's always very unpredictable. I really hope for Jack Miller this weekend that, he just stays out of the biff and barge, because, once he gets into all those politics and, arguing and all that stuff with the other riders, I would prefer him to, be on a competitive bike. Just so, he can hold his own and, can actually, fight back and just hold himself there in the complex world of MotoGP.
Yeah, he's going to have to keep his head up, particularly if he wants to get a good seat in a few years' time. So we will be back next week to review all the action from the weekend, the Moto Grand Prix at Mugello, the Detroit Grand Prix, IndyCar, and of course, the week after that, we have the Grand Prix, we had the Texas 600 as well, the Firestone 600 at Texas Motor Speedway for IndyCar. Got in 3 weeks of IndyCar. That's quite exceptional. And of course, Formula One will be back in a couple of weeks in Canada as well. We will see you next week to wrap up all the action. I've been Naveen Razik.
And I've been Josh Carroll.
And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.